everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me again for another opportunity to have a inspiring, uplifting conversation, as always, because this program is really about empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And I want to just jump right into our conversation today because it's quite a conversation. We're going to be talking about a new book called Find a Way, The Inspiring Story of One Woman's Pursuit of a Lifelong Dream, with my guest, Diana Nyad. And it's really, we're going to be talking about her personal account of overcoming fears and never being too old to live your dreams. It's a great message. It's a very inspiring story. And I just want to share a little bit about Diana before we jump into our conversation. For her maverick open water performance of the 1970s, Diana Nyad was known as the world's greatest long-distance swimmer. For the next 30 years, Diana was a prominent sports broadcaster and journalist, filling compelling stories for National Public Radio, ABC's Wild World of Sports, and others. She is a national fitness icon, has written 3 other books, is a talented linguist, and is one of today's most powerful and engaging public speakers. Diana was a world champion in her 20s, setting the record for swimming around Manhattan Island, along with other ocean swim achievements, all of which rendered her a star at the time. Back then, she made the first attempt at the Mount Everest of swims, the Cuba swim. But after 42 hours and 79 miles, she was blown desperately off course. Her dream unfulfilled, she didn't swim in another stroke for the next 3 decades. On September 2, 2013, at the age of 64, Diana emerged onto the sands of Key West after swimming 111 miles nation to nation, Cuba to Florida, in an epic feat of both endurance and human will in 53 hours. Diana carried 3 poignant messages on her way across the stretch of shark-infested waters, and she spoke them to the crowd in her moment of final triumph. And these are the 3 messages. Never give up. You're never too old to chase your dreams. It looks like a solitary sport, but it's a team. And it's my pleasure to welcome Diana Nyad to the show today. Hello, Diana.
Dr. Selman, what a pleasure to be with you. May I call you Cheryl? I'm probably older than you are, so I think I can.
Well, that's a top secret. I never give that away, but we're close, Diana. We're close.
Okay.
And Cheryl is just fine.
Cheryl's good. Well, we're both in the prime then. Good to know.
We are both getting younger, healthier, fitter every moment of every day. And that's such an inspiring message from your story. So Diana, let's just start by, you know, sharing with my audience just a brief bit of your own personal history that got you into this grueling sport of long-distance swimming. What drove you? What was the impetus that made you take this on?
You know, I tell you, I'm just going to take a tangent of that because it might be a bit more interesting toward my, you know, the truth of my story, the soul of it, and that is Cuba. I grew up in southern Florida, just a little bit north of Miami. Just as the Cuban Revolution happened, thousands of Cuban exiles flooded into my hometown, literally overnight in 24 hours, and I was a little swimmer already. I was already into the commitment of 4:30 in the morning, 1,000 sit-ups every night, and I literally stood on the beach with my French mother when I was 9 years old, and I said, Mom, I was filled with the mystique of that forbidden land right off our coast. I said, Mom, where is it? I can't see Cuba. I want to see it. Where is it? And she says, okay, lift your arm up this way. No, a little bit this way. There. It's right there. As a matter of fact, it's 100 miles away. It's so close that you little swimmer, you could almost swim over there. So honestly, Cheryl, I became a champion ocean swimmer in my 20s, but always I held records, you know, world records, Manhattan Island, Bahamas to Florida. We could make the list, and I'm very, you know, proud of all those swims, but always it was about Cuba. Cuba, for me, wasn't another sporting event. It wasn't a swim. It was an emblem of chasing a probably impossible dream. And to get there, you'd have to tap into every fiber of your potential, touch every drop of your courage, and surround yourself with a team who felt the same thirst for excellence, for adventure, for history, and for noble friendship. So for me, Cuba always was about something very grand. It was about living life to the nth degree.
Well, so that was instilled in you when you were just a child. Little did you know that that was part of your destiny when you stood there on the shore with your mother.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. My father, when I was 5 years old, he was a Greek, and he was a Greek Orthodox. I wound up an atheist. So, you know, we all develop our world views as we go along. And he read to me from the dictionary. You know, the word naiad comes from Greek mythology, and it actually meant the little nymphs that were the swimmers. The naiads in Greek, oddly enough, were the little nymphs that swam in the lakes and rivers and fountains and oceans to protect the seas for the gods, you know, mythologically. But my father very much believed in destiny, and he read to me from the dictionary when I was 5 years old, and his accent, by the way, was thicker than my mother's. But he read to me, you know, look, darling, you are looking here. It says your name, Naiad, my name, the name of my people. It says girl or woman, champion, swimmer. Oh, my God, this is your destiny, darling. Well, I did become a champion swimmer, but honestly, very early in life, and I don't argue with anybody's philosophies. Your religion, your worldview is yours. Your life is yours. I have respect for everybody's, but me, I don't believe in destiny. I don't believe in it was meant to happen. I think you do have luck on your side. You have good fortune occasionally. You have bad luck occasionally. Mainly, you make things happen. No white knight rides through town and determines your destiny. That's just me. But so, you know, I never looked at any of it as destiny, but there were things that stirred my soul when I was a child, and they stayed with me a long, long time.
So I'm curious to know what happened in those 30 years, those three decades, between winning all those championships and then not, I don't know what you did in those, you know, decades between it, and then what stirred you to take on this challenge three decades later?
Well, you know, some people do know what I was doing during those 30 years. I was a rather prominent sports broadcaster. I worked for National Public Radio as a commentator for many years. And with the wide world of sports, I traveled the world as an announcer, announcing Olympic Games and Wimbledon's and Tour de France competitions. But I had tried Cuba, Cheryl, when I was 28 years old, and it was the Holy Grail. As I said before, it was the emblem of living a life full of passion, and I didn't make it. I went 42 hours into that vast, dangerous wilderness, didn't make it, couldn't get back in the next year, which was 1979. I was 29, nor the next year, 1980, when I was 30. We were denied our visas. I was training and sacrificing, and we couldn't get there. And I left my Cuba dream behind. It was time for me to move on to a career. Most athletes at a world-class level retire at about 30. It seemed like the time, even though no matter how wonderful those travels were, chasing after the greatest athletes on earth, pursue their excellence, I always had Cuba. I had Cuba on my mind. I followed the swimmers who tried to make it. They had been trying, the best swimmers in the world, since 1950, and they still tried during the three decades that I wasn't swimming. And I like to think myself a sporting person. I certainly never wished anybody any harm, but I will admit that each time one of those swimmers would fail, I do a little happy dance at home. Like, oh, you know, the dream is still alive somehow for me. And then I turned 60. And I was just, I never worried about age before that. I did worry about the clicking of the proverbial clock. But I didn't worry about cosmetic aging or, you know, the angst of time passing too much. But turning 60, I did. My mom just died. I had just become friends with Christopher Reeve after he had had his horse accident and had become a quadriplegic. And Chris was very big on regrets. Don't let anything that you want to do go till tomorrow. Do it all today. He used to say that. And I was just feeling kind of all of a sudden I had this career. I was storyteller about these great athletes and their poetry and their philosophies. And all of a sudden, I started to feel a spectator. I wasn't a doer anymore, and it made me ill at ease. It made me feel like, you know, I wanted to grasp on to a dream, and it hit me. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I hadn't swum a stroke in 30 years. Would the shoulders come back? Would the will be there? But I knew that Cuba was the dream that made me feel alive and awake and alert to the full throttle degree, and that's why I went back and started chasing that old dream again at the age of 60.
Well, I mean, you took on this immense challenge. Your dream was very big, wasn't it? Considering you hadn't really been swimming for 30 years, that just seems like an impossible dream to many, I'm sure.
Yeah, and it's even if you are swimming for 30 years, it's a big dream. As I said, they call it the Mount Everest of the Earth's oceans. If you and I were to get into your studio today and take all the nautical charts of the Earth's surface, excluding the polar and Antarctic waters that are too cold to last that long, we couldn't find Mother Nature raging on steroids. We couldn't find a more difficult set of obstacles for a swimmer to get across in a 100-mile passage than the ones that exist between Cuba and Florida. So in the beginning, yeah, I hadn't swum for 30 years. I stayed in, you know, badass shape. I did a 100-mile bike ride every Friday. I had a fitness business. I just wasn't in swimming shape. But I got there fairly quickly. So it wasn't a matter so much of that I hadn't swum for 30 years. It was a matter of what's out there. It's just that, you know, if you went to Vegas, no matter what swimmer were trying it, young, male, strong, you would be given a 0% chance of making it across that channel.
Because no one had ever done it before.
And because of the reasons no one had ever done it before. It's the Gulf Stream. It's the currents within the Gulf Stream. It's the eddies that swirl on the edge of the Gulf Stream. It's the oceanic white tips, the aggressive sharks that swim 50, 60 miles offshore with no bait fish to feed on. They may not eat for a week or two. And if a swimmer making a low-frequency vibration on the surface, signaling wounded fish, those sharks from 2 miles away hear that vibration, and they come in a hurry. The box jellyfish is the most potent venom on Earth. There is no venom, spider, snake, eel, whatever it is, that could kill you as quickly. 90% of the people who have ever been touched by a tentacle of the box jellyfish die instantaneously. I should have died. On my third attempt, which was the fall of 2011, I ran into a swarm of box jellyfish, was stung all over the biceps, the forearms, the neck. I should have died that night. I'm lucky I lived, and I tell you, I don't wish that on my worst enemy. So I'm just trying to paint a picture of the conditions that are out there and how many of them collude the variables against you. The chance of getting lucky and getting all of that going your way and not being hit by any of those conditions as you go across are very, very slim.
Right. Yeah, the odds are against you. So you attempted in 2011, and then that was your second attempt, and the third attempt was the 2013?
No, I tried it 5 times. So you go back to the 70s was number one. In 2011, yes. I tried it twice. In 2012, I tried it for the fourth time. And then 2013 was our victory walk up onto the beach, the fifth time.
So I have to ask you, Diana, what goes on inside you that makes you return again and again to not only this huge challenge, but also facing the potential pain, suffering, hardship, death of such an attempt?
I think if, you know, we were to have a chance to sit down with all the major adventurers of Mother Earth, the people who are the big alpine climbers who go up Everest and Annapurna and K2, the people who run across the Kalahari Desert in Africa, who trek across Antarctica, you would find that these people have a resolve. Once their imagination is stirred by getting to the top of the world, they're set. Their mind is set like titanium. And so they come back from these expeditions if they fail, and they have knowledge. They come back with a steep learning curve of science and technology and perhaps a new way to tap into the human spirit, new levels of friendship and dedication, and they go back. They go back with new, you know, sets of parameters of how to do it better. And so my resolve was set for this. It was actually set a long time ago. It was set 35 years, you know, before I came back to try it again. And I was a believer. It didn't matter to me what other people's limitations were of age or of gender or of, you know, ability. I was a believer that if I trained hard enough, I was dedicated enough, I was ferocious enough in my preparation. If I surrounded myself with the best in the world, and I did, Dr. Angel Yanagihara, the leading world's expert on the box jellyfish, I believed that we would be the first expedition to make it all the way across. And we were.
Yeah, and it truly was an expedition. So I want to talk about some of those profound lessons that you learned and are sharing with people, but I just have to ask you to share with us some of the highlights, or if that's the right word, of those experiences when you were making that final crossing. I know you encountered some challenges. Do you want to just share a little bit about what were some of those challenges for you on your successful swim from Cuba to Florida that you overcame?
Well, you know, once you start, it's a mission. So, you know, on training swims, and frankly, I am, sort of more swept up with the pride of the training, of the discipline, and the constant push through those grueling, lonely hours for years and years without ever sacrificing. If I said, we got to do a 15-hour swim today in the Caribbean, that's what I need. That's what my body needs, my mind needs. The crew needs it, you know, to work on their order of command and handle crises and communications together. So let's say we've done the 15 hours, and this happened all the time, and it was kind of a rough day. I had vomited a bit from the seasickness. My shoulder took a beating from bashing into a very windy day of waves. And we come into the dock. It's now nighttime. You know, we all can't wait to finish, all of us. And it's now, when I go to touch the dock, it's 14 hours and 58 minutes. Well, does it matter? Does it matter to anybody? It's our crew. I'm the one who said we're going to do the 15 hours. Is 2 minutes really a big deal in the scope of 15 hours? Well, to me, it was. To me, you start making concessions, and then the next concession is going to be bigger. And then bigger and bigger, and pretty soon that resolve of yours that was like titanium gets eaten into. So Bonnie, my head handler, knows this. And when I'd reach the dock, she would say, I'm sorry, Diana, I know you're hurting. I know it's been a long, long day. Turn around. We got 2 minutes to go. Swim a minute out. I'll blow a whistle. Swim the minute back in, and we'll have a true 15 hours. So there was something about the focus. There was something about the determination of it that put me on a high. And I refused to get off that high until we finally, and I didn't know it was going to take that long, until we finally stumbled up onto the beach.
Well, that just must have been an incredible moment for you.
Oh yeah, yes, and I'm sorry, I forgot. I kind of forgot where you were driving with that question. So you said, you know, what are the things that happen? So once you get out on the actual swim, you know, you're just in it. You're in this state of sensory deprivation. You don't see, you don't hear. You've got a tight cap over your head. You're immersed in a liquid 20 degrees colder than your body temperature. So you're trying to keep the heat in your head with your bathing cap. You've got fogged over goggles over your eyes. You're turning your head literally once every second. So you don't, you know, have any sensory input, and very soon you're off in your own little world. The people up top on the boat, your big expedition, they are taking care of the sharks and the jellyfish and the nutrition and the navigation and the medical. They're working all the crises, and they're in control of the expedition. I'm in my own mind, and all I know is no matter what happens, no matter what pain, no matter what unexpected event comes our way, I'm going to make the left arm come up again, and then the right arm, and then the left arm, and then the right arm until we get there. So, you know, I could say I went through chills. I was, you know, very cold that second night. Even though you're in tropical water, you're still in a water colder than your body temperature. I was cold. I was shivering. I was hallucinating. I thought I saw the Taj Mahal over here on the right. It's not that that's so scary. It's that while I'm stopping to look at the Taj Mahal, the East Current is dragging me off to the east, and we're getting off course. Bonnie is begging me to stop looking at the Taj Mahal and get swimming to the north. So I was you know, somewhat out of it, somewhat at the end of the thread, but the will somehow keeps ticking on underneath. The will of the soul keeps ticking, even if the body is suffering. And so I went through a lot on that swim, as you always do. Any long, long, long passage like that, you're going to go through all the mental and physical ups and downs. You do feel well sometimes. You feel like you're swimming over the curvature of the earth. You're in this, immersed in this blue jewel of a planet, of our Earth, and I would feel like, how lucky am I to be traveling, to be cruising from nation to nation, you know, and in this marvelous adventure. So I had ups too. It wasn't all suffering.
Well, especially when you're in those altered states, I'm sure you go to some interesting places.
Yes, you're tripping the light fantastic out there is what you're doing. I'm going to miss that, frankly.
So has anyone since you broke that record achieved it as well?
You know, no one's even tried it. It's been almost 3 years. It'll be 3 years this Labor Day, and people do wonderful swims all over the world. I have marathon swimmer friends whom I admire very much who kid me and say, oh, great, what am I supposed to do now, you know? I'm doing great things. I'm swimming across freezing Lake Tahoe. I'm going to, you know, to go across the Sea of Japan next summer. But once you do Cuba, you've done the Mount Everest, and it kind of everything else pales in comparison. But I tell you, it's not an easy expedition to put together. The box jellyfish are a deadly animal to try to swim through. It's not an easy thing. People don't just many people have written me saying they're going to go, and I haven't seen any of them jump in the water from Havana yet.
Well, did you encounter any sharks on that final attempt?
They're out there on every attempt. Yeah, they live there. That's their territory. They hear you from very far away. They're intelligent animals. They have a signal when you're coming by from as many as 2 miles away. I have kayakers near me, two of them, who have something called a shark shield. It's a device that emits an elliptical field of electricity under me. And most sharks, with their very sensitive ampullae, which is their snouts, they don't like to come up through that electricity. On the other hand, we've been shown many films by marine biologists that a shark that's hungry and aggressive will come right through that electricity and get what they want. So the next line of defense were my divers. I had four guys They're used to diving in tropical waters with these particular sharks, the oceanic white tip, the tiger, the lemon, and they, all night long, we use no lights. Lights attract jellyfish. Lights attract sharks. So they, in the pitch black of night, and Cheryl, how am I ever going to thank those guys? They put my life ahead of theirs. They go down with no spear gun, no fatal equipment. We kill no animal on our watch. They have little, you know, triangles of PVC piping. And when the eyes of a too curious shark comes up and thrashes around close to me, they poke that guy in the snout, and they edge him down and away and get them curious about them instead of me. As I said, how am I ever going to thank them?
Wow. How many people were a part of your team?
Well, the total of the team numbered 44. On the interior side, you know, the people at the epicenter close to me and dealing with me directly, there were 17. But we need to operate 5 boats because those 17 people need to be taken care of. They need meals. They need sleep. Bonnie's the only one who didn't sleep the entire way. They need to be fresh. Those shark divers need to be taken care of, and every time they come over for their shift, it's exhausting to swim underwater against resistance when a swimmer is swimming a lot faster along the surface. Try to keep up with her at the same time that you're looking around in the pitch black and trying to see the eyes of the shark. So, you know, it's tough work for all of them, and we had a team of 44. And when I was about 2 hours from the end, we could see the palm trees, bright blue skies, and now we still didn't feel like, you know, it's a done deal. You want to touch terra firma before you believe that nothing bad's going to happen. But I asked the team to come around. They made a semicircle with their 5 boats around me, and I cried. I cried like a baby. And I said, I guess I'm going to stumble up on that beach pretty soon. I guess somebody's going to take my picture. But don't you ever forget my team, my teammates, that we did this together. We made history together. And that's the truth. I'll never forget them. President Obama invited me into the Oval Office when it was over, and he said, Diana, you and your team set the way for us. We are now making the political moves, but you stepped off the shore of that country. 53 hours you touched the shore of the other country, and you showed us that we should be two nations that can touch each other again. And our team went to Havana to receive a medal from Fidel Castro, and we stood in his palace, and for the first time since 1959, they played the Star Spangled Banner. We wept, but it was all of us. It was the entire team who received those accolades, not just me.
Well, that sounds like such a symbolic swim in that regard. You know, first time making that successful connection between those two countries, and then everything that followed since. Who knows, huh?
You know, it was. I mean, you know, I the very first story that I was recounting to you of being 9 years old and being fascinated with that, you know, as I said, forbidden, you know, island out there, Cuba. You know, I always felt like, what a shame that we don't go there and those wonderful people don't come here. You know, when is that ever going to change? I won't pretend that was the absolute drive of my swim. It was a very personal goal. As I said before, it was my holy grail, you know, to living big, living large, being everything I could be. But, you know, we do things in a complex way. We have multiple motivations, and connecting our two countries together was definitely one of them for me.
So, since your successful swim, what's your passion? What's motivating you now at this point in your life?
I think that it started for me from maybe age of 4 or 5. I've always been in exemplary shape. It just, you know, the body's the temple. And what makes me feel strong and competent and confident and happy is being in terrific, badass shape. So I am not that, you know, world-class swimmer anymore. I am not going to swim any other big swims in the ocean. No other swim could touch my soul the way Cuba did. But I'm determined, and Bonnie, my buddy, the Cuban expedition leader, we are starting an initiative called Everwalk. I would appreciate it if you check it out online. It's called everwalk.com. We are going to, starting this fall, for the next 5 years, walk epic distances all around the great corridors of America. We're going to start this fall with L.A. to San Diego. Next year, we're going to go Chicago to St. Louis and Philadelphia to D.C. and Boston to New York City. The next year, we're going to go Dallas to New Orleans and Orlando to Miami and Portland, Oregon, up to Seattle. So you get the picture. We are going to walk all over America, and we're going to get thousands of people to do it with us. What do they say? Sitting is the new smoking. We're going to get people up, and we're going to give them an epic experience to walk these beautiful, long, you know, week-long, two-week-long walks and feel like they love this country. We won't be as divisive as we are. We'll be shoulder to shoulder, no matter what your political views are. And we are literally going to change the collective health of America. We're going to become a nation of walkers. And in 2020, after we've walked all over the place, we're going to go cross-country, Pacific to the Atlantic, and we're going to get a million people, literally, to do it. That's the next big thing, Cheryl.
I think that would probably fulfill the next big mission. That would work. You've got your, you know, next 5 years or so planned out. It's a wonderful vision, Diana. It's a wonderful vision of inspiring people to get off their butts and start walking, which opens so many possibilities for health. You know, I mean, you're an extreme athlete, but even people who just start moving their bodies can have so much improvement. Not just, you know, we think about it as weight loss, but actually their immune system is improved. Their genes are turned on. They are preventing a dementia and Alzheimer's. We forget how profound walking is for transforming our health and rejuvenating our bodies, staying young and fit and vital.
There you go. You know, you got it. And then you can, you know, you're naming, and you know only way better than I do, all the long list of, you know, physical issues that can be improved and help the rest of your life, but also your emotional relationships, your self-esteem, your anger management. You know, all of that emotional plateau can come up and up and up with just getting out and strolling along. You don't have to walk at some breakneck speed. So we're going to have people virtually join us as well. Are you in Kansas City, by the way?
I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You coming through Route 66? You got to come through Route 66.
Route 66. We will be. When we go cross country, we're going right through Tulsa. So I expect you to come out and be at the front of the line with us when we go through there.
I'll meet you here, Diana. Yeah. You bet.
There you go. Hey, I'm. You know, that's a commitment, Cheryl. I've got your name written down on the list right now. Tulsa, Dr. Cheryl Selman, right up front. All right. We've got to go.
Well, I love challenges, and I think, you know, we're here to choose goals, and you have some very profound, lofty ones that you have successfully achieved, and we all have our own variations on a theme. But if we're not driving towards a dream, if we're not living a passion, we're not really living, are we? And it comes in all shapes and sizes. Everyone has to find the right shape and size of their dream. But you have to live for something, which is why I actually am not a fan of retirement personally.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And even, you know, maybe one must, because of, you know, societal standards, retire from one's actual job. But that doesn't mean you retire from being engaged. You know, I don't know about you, but I love that word engage and engagement, you know, because, you know, people think that I'm just all about, you know, setting big world records and, you know, as you said, lofty goals. But the truth is what I admire is just plain engagement. Somebody who walks out their door, they know their neighbors, they know who's in need. They go down to the local shelter and help out if they have a little bit of free time. They know which of their family members, you know, could use a little bit of extra love these days. I don't have many judgments. You know, everybody lives their own life. and we're all traveling these one-way streets, and you never get to do any day over again, so you make your choices. But one thing I don't admire is locking the door, isolating, sitting in front of screens all day, and not engaging, even with your own potential, with your own happiness and health. And I won't say that I don't admire it, but I must say I feel sorry for it. I feel bad about it. Whereas when I see a kid who's, you know, 15 years old and they want to volunteer at school to go down to the retirement center and play games, you know, with some of the elderly people, or take their dog down there so everybody can pet the dog and, you know, feel better. Now I admire that kid. That kid is engaged. And I think that that's where a lot of, you could tell me, but I think that obesity and depression and, you know, diabetes and a number of the ills that affect our society in big ways come from being sedentary and not engaging. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like you lose your mojo. You lose your will, your excitement about life and the drive to just get out and feel the energy in your body. You know, and that's...
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
So Diana, what are some of the other lessons that you've been sharing with people from your extraordinary life? And, you know, what are some of the inspirations that you're passing on?
Well, you know, the second thing that I muttered when I finally got out on the shore there, I was pretty dazed physically and mentally, but I managed those three phrases that you said in the beginning. And that second one was, you're never too old to chase your dreams. But the truth is, to start with too old, I just, you know, I don't ever pretend to be any age than I am. I'm 66. I'll be 67 in about a month. And so be it. You know, the breasts are riding a little bit lower than they used to. You know, there are definitely, you know, wrinkles and issues, that have, cosmetic issues that have come onto the skin, et cetera. Well, I can't do anything about all that. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm 25 or even 45 or 55. I am this age. On the other hand, I refuse to listen to society's metrics. And let's say the, you know, the health world's metrics that go on the average 66-year-old as to what we should be able to do and how we should be feeling. People often start conversations with me saying, well, you know how it is. At our age, meaning mine and this person's, you know, we're beginning to feel arthritic pain and we don't have as much energy. And I said, whoa. Don't speak for an entire group and an entire generation. Speak for yourself. Are you feeling arthritic pain? Are you feeling less energy? Because I'm not. You know, I am in the prime of my life, and I include physically. Now, if you and I are talking 20 years from now, when I'm 86, will I say the same thing? Probably not. I'll probably have to get real with 86 and some different physical manifestations I'll be dealing with, but I intend to be healthy and vital all the days of my life. But at this age, you know, we are defining, we 60-something-year-olds are defining a new vision of what it is not to be young. Young is 20. Young is 30. Middle-aged is 40 and 50 and 60. So I don't pretend to be young, but I am energetic and vital and ready. If you called me tomorrow and said, hey, Diana, we got a group of friends and I, we're going down to Machu Picchu. We've been training for it for a year, and one of them can't go. He's got a crisis, and we got an extra ticket. You want to go with us? I'm ready. I am ready today. I'm ready for bear. So when I say you're never too old to chase your dreams, I truly mean it. And I think it depends what the dream is, maybe. But I refuse to be defined. I don't wake up saying, oh, well, I'm 66. I better slow it down. I wake up feeling like I feel. And if it's pretty terrific, which it always is, then there's no 66. There's no age. And on the reverse end of that, I talk to millennials all the time. And I even talk to younger people, teenagers. And I say to them, you're never too young to chase your dreams either. And it's true. Age is, you know, we take the definition of age in this country way too seriously, you know. Just look yourself in the mirror and feel yourself and flex your muscles and go out and do what you want to do. Don't think of, oh, I'm supposed to be doing this because I'm this age. It's just I rail against all that.
I think one of our greatest enemies is buying this cultural message that we get, that there's this number, in this case 66, we're talking about 66, there's a number, and we believe, and we've been taught, or you know, if you watch enough ads on television that tells us how we're supposed to be feeling as we get older, the aches and pains in the eyes are going to go, and the arthritis is going to set in, and this, you know, you're getting programmed, and but it's just a number. And you know, I'm like you, Diana. You know, I feel like I'm the fittest I've ever been, the healthiest I've ever been. And when you're fit and healthy, you are ageless. You are ageless. You don't feel, you know, you only feel old when you're in pain and achiness and you're lacking energy. That's not about a number. That's about the state of your health. That's about the quality of how you've been eating and living and what you've been doing for yourself. Age is really an expression of to what degree we are accessing our life force or not. It's not a number.
And there you go.
You know, does that make sense
there
to you?
There you go. Well said.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
And well, you know, said. I can't say it any better. That's perfect. Yeah.
You know, because I've really been aware of that. You know, when you feel really healthy, I go, well, how old do I feel? I don't feel like any age. I just feel alive, you know. And I think that's the ageless place we want to hold within us, because if we can continue holding the thought that we're ageless, that's the message our cells are getting. We are ageless.
You know, that's it. And, you know, we could take that other issue. And I know that, you know, this is a big issue with you and the show that you do is women. You know, we how long have we fought to say that gender, you know, we're not trying to be men. We're not men. And there is a difference between the sexes. And as they say in France, vive la différence. You know, males are beautiful and the male body is beautiful, but we are women, and in terms of our abilities to be leaders and to be doctors and to do anything we want on this planet, even become president of the United States, you know, what has gender got to do with it? You know, age, to get back to age, now that we went over to, you know, President of the United States for just a minute. I don't care. Let's not get into it. Let's not get into Hillary and Trump and Bernie and all of it. But the one thing I have truly noticed this year, besides their messages and their personalities, is that Trump is just turning 70. Bernie's been 74 this last year. Hillary's 68 going on 69. And none of us have found them lazy, tired people. These three people have slept 3 hours a night for a year. They kiss babies. They shake hands. They go to three cities a day and give tireless speeches. So, again, regardless of what they're talking about and, you know, who would make the best leader of the free world, they are very good representatives of their age in this youth-driven culture. I haven't heard one complaint this year about them. The only complaint about age among the candidates I heard the whole year long was about Marco Rubio, and that was, he's too young. So I think it's been a wonderful show of vitality, these three people, and the way they've presented themselves in terms of age this year.
Hey, you know, I don't think we realize what a marathon and an ongoing and a very long marathon they're all running right now, because it's been going on for so long and it's so demanding, and they're still up and standing and going.
They're still smiling. They're still, I do. They are endurance athletes,
yeah,
of sorts. They truly are. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think your message is so profound, and I am sure you'll be inspiring so many people to be walking with you and seeing this fantastic country and exploring it. And I know that you know, you're such an inspiration, and I guess there's just, you know, one last question I want to ask you, Diana. What were, if any, and I'm sure we all have those programs that limit us, that get in our way. What were some of the issues that you had to address, resolve, heal, that let you be successful this final time? Was there something that shifted in you?
Well, I don't think I was particularly, you know, motivated by negatives, shall we say. You know, there were certainly people, the entire marathon swimming world, even my own team, even Bonnie, my closest friend, who believed in me more than anybody. By the time we were going, or I was going a fifth time, they all, 100%, said, Diana, if anybody could have done it, it would have been you. It just can't be done. We've seen it. We've seen it up close. There's too much out there. The universe sometimes is bigger than we are. You've got to find the grace to say it was a beautiful dream. The journey itself was worthwhile, and I've got to turn now to a different dream. And you know what? I find it somewhat petty. I'm not motivated by saying, you know what? I'm going to do it just so I can point in their faces and say, I told you so. I'm going to show you wrong. I never felt that way. Anybody who said to me, it can't be done, I don't want to go again, I felt sadness. Bonnie, I worked all year to try to hope that she would come back around. Same thing with John Bartlett, our navigator. He wasn't going. He came back around. But I was never motivated by thinking, you know, I just can't wait to rub it in everybody's face. I just find that negative, and I'm trying to go onward and upward and forward all the time instead of dragging backwards, you know? So I don't think there was anything like that. I think that just the resolve got stronger and stronger. Every time I didn't make it, we'd learn more, and I was more of a believer rather than less of a believer each time we went along.
You know, I think that's such a powerful lesson right there. The more you did not achieve that goal in that moment, it made your resolve greater to do it again and get there. That is a powerful lesson for people to hear right there.
No, it is. I mean, you know, I have a friend who died of cancer at 32, three kids, great husband, great family, and she was a fighter. Every step she went, all the chemo, all the radiation, different types of therapies, and she'd walk back in, you know, after going through a number of them, and the doctors would sit with her, and they'd be, you know, gritting their teeth and say, oh, it's bad news. This isn't what we wanted. We're not getting the results we wanted. She got tougher. She didn't go down. She didn't get sad. She didn't even get mad. She just got grittier and tougher and said, okay, then let's go to London. I hear that there's a particular therapy they're using over there. And everybody supported her. They raised the money. They went with her everywhere around the world. And she lost in the end. Just bad luck. Sometimes bad things happen to good people. And she lost in the end. And she found the grace to say goodbye to her children with a smile instead of crying. But, you know, how could I admire anybody more than that? But I did notice that she never went down. She never went to self-pity. She just, even in leaving her family and leaving her young life, she didn't go down. She got stronger and stronger all the way. As a matter of fact, she was probably stronger in that moment than she was even in facing the cancer she went along, in saying goodbye, you know?
Mm. Yeah, that's, you know, it's an inspirational story. And I just want to, you know, complete our conversation. I know you have a busy day of interviews, but, you know, your book, Find a Way, is a fantastic book. It's gotten rave reviews. And I guess I want to ask you, what really was your intention? What was your ultimate intention, the big intention for writing this book?
I think it was to be as authentic as I could be and not to proselytize. You know, I do have life stories, and you and I, you know, clicked on that quite a bit, and I'm happy to express them. But the truth is, I don't want to tell people how to live a life. I want to tell people how I've come to live a life, and I'm still learning all the time, you know, new lessons and being inspired by other people. But I wanted to sit down and write a true story that would resonate just by how authentic it was, If you and I went tonight to hear Sheryl Sandberg, you know, give a speech, if we went to hear Yo-Yo Ma tell a life story, you know, maybe, I don't know about you, but I know I wouldn't have any, you know, particular knowledge of the cello or classical music, but I bet you anything we would sit there and we would, I think you used the word in the beginning of this interview, we would extrapolate for our own lives those particular philosophies and life lessons. And we all read biographies and memoirs so that we can read a life story. Billie Jean King, Amelia Earhart. We can read these stories, and we're not going to be aviators. We're not going to be Wimbledon champions, but we pluck from them, you know, what we want for our lives. And that's what I wanted about this book. I wanted it to be my life story, my true, authentic life story, and then you read it and you pluck from it what you think might help you in your quest. And I do believe it is and has been and will be successful in that regard.
Well, I'm sure it will as well, and I really encourage everyone to read Diana Nyad's book, Find a Way, the inspiring story of one woman's pursuit of a lifelong dream, because it's a great read, Diana. So congratulations on and some great photos, by the way. But it's a great read. You know, you did such a great job engaging the reader in your adventures. I mean, I felt I was struggling along with you in the water, I have to say. It's like, God bless that woman. I don't know how she did it, but it was amazing.
Well, thank you.
You know,
thank you so much.
And the best website, if people want to learn more about you, is Diana Nyad, and that's NYAD, the little water nymph, NYNAD.com, DianaNyad.com. And what was the other website for your walking again?
Everwalk. Thank you for asking. It's Everwalk. Everwalk.com.
Okay, so Everwalk.com. Oh, awesome.
Yep.
So, Diana, thank you so much. Wishing you all the best on your book and the inspiration, and we'll see you in Tulsa. I'll be at the head of the line walking with you, I promise.
Don't forget. Okay, Cheryl, thanks for all your time and your respect. I appreciate it. Bye.
You have been a delight. Thank you so much. And
bye-bye.
Bye, Diana. And to all of you listening, thank you. It's been such an honor to have you with me today. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.